Okay, my atomic watch says it's 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
Should we do a few more minutes? Or is that a spot on my screen or on my face? There it goes on the screen. Good morning. Hey, how was the talk this morning with Geshe-la's teacher? Did any of you hear?
It went very well.
Yeah.
A few of us were here for it.
Excellent. So. So even though there might be more, it might be that because of that great event this morning that there won't be as many people today as there were yesterday, but we will start with a little meditation so they will miss out if they come in the next minute, or they'll join. So I'd like to begin with watching the breathing because it's so accessible. And it's part of the Buddha's teachings in the Theravada. As one of the participants mentioned the other day, you know, the teachings there are that are so important. And the Buddha said that they should be embraced by the bodhisattvas, but the goal of that path, the Hinayana path, shouldn't be actualized. You should actualize the goal of enlightenment. So the watching of the breathing is what's encapsulated in what's called a close placement of mindfulness, satipatthana in Pali. You've probably heard of that, some meditation courses. In Sanskrit, sati is actually smirti, which means mindfulness, and patthana in Sanskrit is upasthana, to place. So there's always a little difference between Sanskrit and Pali. I've joked before. Pali is a little bit like thinking John Kennedy pronouncing Sanskrit. You know, instead of saying karma, it's kama. Things like that. Pak the ka and the ha vidyad. So I mentioned in one of the other courses that one of my teachers, Kepchi Song Rinpoche, had mentioned when I had asked him, why is it that we don't find these same practices that you find in the Theravada courses that were so popular? Maybe they still are, Goenka courses and Satipatthana courses. And he said, of course, those are obviously important objects of mindfulness. But in Mahayana, the main object of mindfulness is the bodhicitta, so the mind training. So what we're the subject matter of what we're talking about, the eight verses, is what we can be cognizant of during the day, as opposed to watching your walking and your eating. And of course, those can also be done. But we begin by watching the breathing because the mind rides on its mounted wind or prana. And that prana, even though that's subtle, it is related with our breathing. One can sort of influence the other. They're of a different category. So let's begin again by, you know, sitting comfortably. Relax your body. Let your shoulders, your back, your buttocks, your legs, your feet relax. Relax your mind and place your mindfulness, your attention, on the breathing, the whole cycle, especially where it changes direction, never letting go of that, and in so doing, deprive other conceptual thoughts of their sustaining energy, which is our attention. If you don't pay attention to them, they begin to subside. So let's begin there again, as we did before. if you like to make it a little more, not more difficult, but more challenging, count your respirations in addition to watching the breathing. So it gives your mind two focal objects, both trying to recall what breath you're at, and counting an inhalation and exhalation as one. So this is the first inhalation. This is the first exhalation, so forth. And if you lose count, or you don't remember whether you're breathing in or breathing out, go back to one. If you're having a little success there, you can bring your attention to the mental consciousness as we did before, which is much more subtle and difficult to recognize. More easily recognized are the objects of the consciousness, the thoughts, the images, memories, opinions. Here, what we're trying to look at is the nature of the mind within which those thoughts are arising. And it's what is referred to in Buddhism, the Buddha called the clear light nature of the mind. Here we're talking about the conventional clear light nature. It's something that's not glimpsed with the eyes. It's not felt with the body consciousness. It's known with the, what we could call the eye of wisdom, the wisdom eye. The fact that there is space between the thoughts, a clarity, you begin to get a mental image of. Even at the moment, thoughts impinging upon you ceaselessly, simply changing your orientation and watch the spaciousness of the mind within which they're arising, depriving those thoughts of their sustaining energy, which is your attention. let go of your attention to the visual input if your eyes are slightly open, recognizing that your mental consciousness is aware of that. And again, focus on the inferred spaciousness of the mind within which that's arising. And so let go of that. Let go of your attention to that. Let go of the looming presence of your body or your breathing, which are being experienced by your tactile consciousness. Even then, there may be a sense of your self who's meditating. Let go of that also. That's just appearing to your mind within this spaciousness as a concept or image. Dive into the spaciousness of your mind, so to speak. Let go of everything else, like a dakini, dhaka. The Tibetan etymology of those words is khandro, one who goes, drowa, in the space of the mind, which is the ka, khandro. Even let go of your, what you are imagining is the spaciousness of the mind. That too, at this point, is just an imagination of that actual spaciousness, clear light nature. And try to go deeper to experience the actual spaciousness of the mind within which even that appearance of the mind is arising. It has no space or color, not like ordinary objects of sight of the ordinary eyes. And recalling within this clarity and calmness, the auspicious situation we find ourselves in now as a human being, the life of leisure from the unfree states, and all of the essential richnesses that we need in order to practice the Dharma. Rather than making some plans to be, you know, successful within cyclic existence, you know, to have more pleasure or fame or fortune, wealth, whatever, to think the particular usefulness or meaning of this life, say the meaning of life, is to be able to use this rare circumstance as a human who's actually able to watch the mind, to generate positive imprints in the mind, positive states of mind, to eliminate the negative, begin to reduce it and eventually eliminate it completely, out of, at first, a sense of our own well-being, the aim of achieving our own happiness, but eventually out of recognizing our equality with all other living beings who have been and are kind, and always will be kind to us, to work for their benefit, to develop these qualities, to become, first of all, a non-irritant to others, eventually at least neutral, and finally to actually benefit sentient beings by our very presence. I think I'm going to participate again today, this afternoon. Listen, weigh the words, contemplate them. Ask questions if necessary, clarify, and occasionally to focus on some insight that you have, which is what's called, which is the process of generating a deeper kind of wisdom called the wisdom arisen from meditation. I'm going to listen, participate in the talk today in order to become enlightened, as Shakyamuni Buddha himself exemplified, for the welfare of all sentient beings, by listening to a rendition of his teachings, the Dharma, trying to actualize them in our mind, the actual medicine, the actual refuge, with the aid of our spiritual friends, the participants in this course, our spiritual teachers. We're like the nurses, they're the Sangha, the community with whose help we can actualize integrating the medicine of Dharma into our minds. So with that motivation in mind, bring your attention back to the present. How are you doing? Okay? I have this nice image behind me, this tanka that was given to me by another monk in Singapore. I helped translate a text for him. It's actually, as you can see, it's quite huge. I think it's about 10 or 11 feet high, whatever. It looks like it's not. Actually, I put my arms up. I don't know. Maybe the camera looks like my arms are beyond it, but my arm width just fits the length of the brocade around the outside. So this is the lineage gurus, what we call the merit field that we visualize in the Guru Puja. And I had mentioned before in the lineage gurus above, the Kadampa Geshis, who are the progenitors, you know, the originators from Atisha of these teachings on training the mind. So before I begin and continue on, we've got two more verses to cover today. Are there any questions that you have lingering from yesterday or the day before? Any clarifications you need? Are you okay? Donna, did you have some questions that you received?
No, I haven't received any questions.
Okay. So we're talking about this great text by Geshe Langri Tamba, who was a disciple of Atisha and Drom Denpa, and the kind of using as a basis for understanding this text, the commentary by Geshe Chekhova, who wrote the 7-point training of the mind. So that comes in occasionally. So we talked about, my way of interpreting the first verse with his response, feeling responsible to bring about the greatest aim of sentient beings, for sentient beings, which is my own achievement of enlightenment in order to lead them, excelling even the wish-fulfilling gem, I will constantly cherish them. And that verse I had mentioned, the line that says, excelling the wish-fulfilling gem, some people say the highest goal, which exceeds the wish-fulfilling gem, is kind of like a line that's hanging there. It can be interpreted both as sentient beings who excel the wish-fulfilling gem, because by cherishing them, your wishes to achieve enlightenment can be brought about, or can mean the enlightenment itself is like a wish-fulfilling gem. In a certain sense, the commentary, even though people translate it as, it looks like it's saying the highest goal which exceeds the wish-fulfilling gem, actually the wish-fulfilling gem is something that you clean, you nurture in a certain way, and in reliance upon that you achieve these great wishes, the fulfillment of your wishes. That's more aligned with the meaning of sentient beings, how we cherish them. And the second verse, so that was mainly talking about the main goal here of cherishing others, seeing the benefit, understanding the benefits of that, and then cherishing them more than oneself. Second verse, with whomever I interact with, in whosever presence, whoever I interact with, I will always consider myself to be the very lowest, and continuing cherishing them, but cherishing them as supreme, more important than myself. So that's emphasizing the diminishing of pride. As I said, the Tibetans say that in the spring, the first grass grows in the valley, and during the summer progresses, begins to grow along the hills, but never grows on the high snowy peaks. So in other words, realizations first grow in the mind that is humble. Then the very important verse that we could spend a whole course on, of course, is the third one, vigilant of my mind stream throughout all my actions, whatever I'm doing, always keeping introspection. Whenever afflictions arise, which I understand to be problematic for myself and others, detrimental to myself and others, the actual word in Tibetan doesn't say harmful, but it's a word that's understood in that way, marung, which means like unsuitable for myself and others. I will confront them, that means I'll recognize them and avert them immediately, without delay, like the guards in front of the king's, the entryway to the king's chamber with their spears, first confronting someone, checking who they are, if they're friend or foe, and then if they're foe, getting rid of them, averting them. So that is an incredible part of our practice, recognizing the delusions in our mind, especially the ones that we don't ordinarily think of as enemies, like attachment. Generally, most people in our culture would say that they recognize anger as an enemy, their own anger. There are some people who think it's good, but you have to use your wisdom to argue with that if that particular devil arises in your mind. But attachment is more difficult to recognize because it seems to be that which brings about our pleasure. And as if we are centered only on the vision of this lifetime, we might think that what was that famous movie with, was it Wall Street or something? I think the famous quote from it, Michael Douglas says, "Greed is good." Was it something like that? Was it? Greed is good. So that's kind of the, and our practice in watching the mind is to recognize that that is an enemy also. Then a verse about dealing with, three verses about dealing with particularly difficult people, people that are of bad character. Whenever I meet beings of bad character who are oppressed with suffering, you know, we might like to avoid, they have leprosy or cancer or AIDS or something, or they're just in great misery and problematic for us. And those who are obsessed with negative actions, you know, creating negativity, instead of avoiding them, whenever I meet beings of bad character, you know, oppressed by great suffering and obsessed with negative actions, I will hold such rare ones dear as if I had, I will cherish them as if I had found a very difficult to find treasure, precious treasure. So this is reminding us of the value of such kind of irritating people for our practice of patience. The bodhisattvas actually go out of their way to embrace these kind of abusive people or people that we would like to avoid. And that's what we should try to train to do. It doesn't mean that you spend all your time with them, you fall under their influence or anything, but that you should recognize the opportunity as one which is giving you a chance to work on patience, especially. And then my memory is going here. The way that I like to put it, I will accept defeats and offer the victory to others, such as when abused by others out of envy, for instance, in other words, unjustly, you know, that's not something that you've actually done. But, and of course, understanding these verses, that means whenever you are hurt by others, to accept the defeat and offer the victory, not to retaliate in kind. The example of being abused by others is just an example. And of course, if you are abused, here it says out of jealousy, if you are abused and you deserve the abuse, you know what I mean? That's even more so, accept the defeat. This is talking about abuse when it's not really justified. And then another kind of individual that's difficult to keep in mind as you're trying to practice a mind training is when someone who you've nurtured, someone who you have taken care of and in whom you have some expectation of their taking, you know, of having respect for you or maybe, you know, not hurting you, when they give you unjust harm, marik in Tibetan, different ways of saying, you could say illogical or, you know, unjust, not right. Rukpa sometimes means it's okay. Unjust harm, I will practice to see them as my holy guru. Right? Is that how far we got last time? I will see them as my virtuous friend, as Lama Zopa says, or as my Shenyan Dampa means my holy friend, someone who's excellent friend, who is helping me practice the Dharma. Because I remember people thinking sometimes, guru, oh, the guru is someone who's great, got great compassion. Almost you think always going to be petting you or holding you. I remember Lama Yeshe would often have that aspect sometimes. But to his close disciples, you know, even in the lecture in front of everyone else, he would point out something not out of bad intention, but But because you had the relationship with the teacher at that point, they could point out your ego so that you could actually work on it, work to eliminate it, work in such a way so that it doesn't dominate you and cause you to create negative karma. So now we come to the final two verses. The seventh verse says in Lama Zopa's translation, in short, both directly and indirectly, I offer every happiness and benefit to all my mothers. It doesn't say my in the Tibetans, it's to all mothers. The implication is my. I offer every happiness and benefit to all my mothers. I secretly take upon myself all their harms and sufferings. And the word mother appears actually in the Tibetan, also occurs in that line. I take upon myself all the harms and sufferings of mothers. At the, you know, poetic justice, poetic license to leave out the word mother a second time. So the sense here, oftentimes this is talking, the commentaries say this is talking about the practice of giving and taking. In earlier translations of this verse, Lama Zopa used to say, in short, both now and in the future continuum. Do you remember, anyone remember that translation? It used to be the FPMT translation long time ago. So what that means is this life and in the future. In the Tibetan, it says Dorna Ngodang Gyupayi. Ngo means actual or direct. That's how Rinpoche was translating, both in this life and in the future continuum. Gyupa, gyu can mean continuum, but perhaps Rinpoche's come around to taking it as directly and indirectly, which is generally how those words are translated. What that can mean generally, the way that it was translated before was that, you know, I will practice in this life and in the future continuum, making some kind of prayers or practices so that it will continue in the future. But directly and indirectly can mean giving every happiness and benefit now, or working now, not just only in Tonglen, you know, actually doing things, you know, helping others when people are sick, helping them when people have problems, when people need you as a friend to be there. I remember Geshe Zopa, my teacher for a long time in Deer Park, who was the teacher of Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa. Geshe Zopa used to say his attendant for many, many years was Alvin Jones. Did any of you know? Right across Alvin? Alvin Jones was a layman at the beginning who was kind of like appropriated the job as Geshe's secretary. And he's a little bit abusive, you know, controlling. He eventually became a monk. I mean, the last 5 or 6 years of his life, he died while he was at Deer Park, just after finishing a Vajrasattva retreat. I almost thought maybe Geshe Zopa transferred his consciousness at that point when he was free of a lot of negativity. But anyway, Geshe used to say, you know, I never wished him to be my secretary. He, you know, it's just like it was karma. And so I just accepted. So he helped Alvin, allowed him to do this. So you can help people directly and indirectly. So the sense of indirectly here is this, what we might call esoteric practice of giving and taking. So even directly, you can take on their sufferings. You can accept the defeat. You can commiserate with others who are in pain right now. But the for those individuals that you don't have an influence over right now to alleviate their pain directly, you can practice indirectly, praying to be able to help them in the future, and imagine taking on their suffering to yourself. Eventually, you might be able to conjoin it with the breathing, but generally, Tonglen, giving and taking, doesn't necessarily have to be done with the breathing. You know that, right? You just imagine, may their suffering ripen on me, taking the responsibility for that. Like the verse in Lama Chopa, the Guru Puja, that when we recite, there's one verse we recite three times, very slowly. Originally in the Guru Puja, which is the verse is essentially about Tonglen. Originally that verse only had four lines and it was recited once, but one of the disciples of the Panchen Lama who composed the Guru Puja, one of his disciples, I think he was the Rinpoche, he made request to the Panchen Lama to allow the text to be amended to have a fifth line, the first line, which says, Dana Jesun Dorje Tukche Chen, you know, therefore, O great compassionate guru, to make it more solemn, and then may all of the sufferings of all mother sentient beings ripen upon me without exception right now, and may all my, my body, my virtues, my possessions be given to them, and thus endow all sentient beings with happiness. That's essentially the verse that we recite three times because of the importance of that practice the Tibetans came to understand, the practice of Tonglen. So this verse can be understood as that, but not just Tonglen, because we say Ngodang Gyupa, so both directly and indirectly. So the indirectly kind of is talking about the practice of directly is actually doing it. Indirectly is kind of talking about Tonglen in imagination, taking on their suffering. In short, both directly and indirectly, I will offer every happiness and benefit to all my mothers, to all mothers. So here the Tibetan, it says, Pende, you know, there's one of our monks, no longer monk, layman, Thubten Pende, who maybe taught at Kadampa Center maybe many years ago. Very common Tibetan name, Pende. So Penpa means benefit. Dewa means happiness or bliss. Here, Rinpoche puts the happiness first and the benefit second. He says happiness and benefit. So sometimes that can mean, rather than just general benefit, can mean well-being and happiness. So I will offer, the Tibetan word is buwa, I will offer to all mothers benefit and happiness. So whatever you can do to help them, whatever help you can give to benefit them, like in the Vajra Chetaka Sutra, you know, the Vajra Cutter Sutra, at the very beginning, the Buddha is talking about how the bodhisattvas benefit sentient beings, you know, how they cultivate their minds and benefit them. They provide cooperative conditions, building monasteries or giving teachings and so forth. And they offer happiness, the direct causes of happiness, which can be sometimes food and clothing and shelter and so forth, but can also be teachings about how to create virtuous karma. Because the virtuous karma that one teaches sentient beings to engage in, all our mothers, is the substantial cause of their future happiness. And also their present happiness as their mind becomes calm and so forth. So in short, both directly and indirectly, I offer every happiness and benefit to all mothers. And here the word secretly I secretly take upon myself all their harms and sufferings. In some of the other versions of this text, although the Tibetan, one of the Tibetan versions I have from the Lotsowa House, which is a place you can go to on the web if you like to have translations of these different texts, both in English and the Tibetan, it's just lotsawahouse.com. 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 So in their version also it has the word secretly, but some of the other versions have instead of the word secretly, sincerely. I will sincerely take upon myself all harms and sufferings of mothers. So to me that makes sense. The way that the word secretly comes about here is that it's the practice of Tonglen is not something that you people actually see. You do in private and secret, right? You take on their sufferings and you imagine giving benefit. Maybe to your eye, there is no change in their behavior or their situation. They're still suffering and so forth. But this is beginning to erode your own self-cherishing thought, developing the courage to be able to work for the welfare of sentient beings. So to my mind, the words directly and indirectly in the first line, that kind of implies the tonglen, the indirectly, already. So that the last line, instead of saying secretly, or the next to the last line in the English translation, secretly take upon myself all mother's harms and sufferings. To say that sincerely, that is emphasizing that you do this from the depth of your heart. It's not just some mechanical thing like you're watching your breathing. You just, all the suffering comes on me, give all my happiness to others, take on the suffering here. You actually sincerely imagine this. Yes, Donna.
The word secretly always kind of implied to me also a sense of doing this humbly, that you're doing it secretly so that you're not, you know, that part of the practice is a humility about it.
Good point. Yeah, so that can be part of it also. Maybe the words, as in some of the other versions where they say ningne, sincerely, from the heart, can also mean that too. But that's a good point, that you're not making a show of this, that you're being humble about this and so forth. So in order to do the practice of Tonglen, sometimes the practice is introduced to people because we've heard that it's such a profound practice. It's almost as though without any introduction, people are just told to imagine this. And even then, it can have great benefits. One of the ways to utilize Tonglen in our own life, well, there's so much to talk about here. One of the ways to utilize it is that when we are experiencing suffering, rather than immediately seeking some kind of alleviation of our suffering, to recognize, of course, this is the result of our past karma, and to recognize that other people are also experiencing the same kind of suffering. If you have a headache, if you have been diagnosed with cancer or COVID-19 or whatever, your own fear and suffering is there. Part of it is physical suffering. Part of it is just the fear and anxiety of the consequences of this. Imagine other people have that same suffering, direct suffering and fear. Imagine, may I, in experiencing this fear, take the place of them. What is it called in sociology? The scapegoat or something like that. I'm going to be the one that takes on all the suffering of others. If there's abuse to be given, You know, we sometimes do that. So in a noble sense, if someone else is going to be accused for a group effort, you might say, no, it was my fault. I take the responsibility. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying? So here, in that same kind of state of mind, if you're suffering, imagine, make use of this. Imagine that by my experiencing this suffering, may others be free of the suffering in the future. And you might say, how is that going to alleviate other people's suffering? Well, as you're doing this for the welfare of others, creating great merit through the practice of Tonglen, here in this case, this is the Lenpa taking, you are getting closer to enlightenment, you're elevating your spiritual state in such a way that you will eventually be able to actually alleviate the suffering of others, which is your goal here. May I take on all the headaches, all the toothaches, all of the low self-esteem of individuals who are criticized because of their race or their overweight or their underweight or their complexion or whatever, you know, whatever people, you know, their status in life or whatever. May I experience that? And in so doing, you develop compassion for others. You may remember, you know, experiencing these states. You may remember I've mentioned in the past, one of the students at the first course I taught at Kopan, Lama Yeshe asked me to teach the spring Kopan course in 1976. I can't remember. I came at 74, 75, 76, maybe. I'd just become a monk. Usually Lama Zopa had taught both the spring and a fall meditation course, as he does now, winter course. And then at a certain point, Lama would have a Western Sangha teach the spring course. So Lama Zopa had a chance to relax a little bit. And there was one fellow who came. He and his wife, the new wife, had been in Micronesia, I think, in those islands in the Pacific, in the Peace Corps, and they were on their way back to the States. He's a smart guy. He came the day after the course started because he only heard about it then, and he wanted to attend and ask permission. I said, sure. He was a graduate of Princeton, very smart guy. And during the meditation on the suffering of the hell realms, when you try to experience what that's like, not just enumerate the sufferings, oh, there's those kind of suffering. Imagine what it's like to be in, you know, being weapons falling from the sky, constantly hitting your shoulders, hitting your head, constantly in pain. And then when you become so weak, you revive again, the reviving hell, and being immersed in molten copper, being pressed down by the karmically imagined protectors of the hell realm. It's, you know, not being able to breathe, swallowing again and again, suffering for an immense amount of time, putting oneself in those situations. And this fellow afterwards said, you know, oh, after the meditation, he came up, he said, wow, I never imagined that I would believe in the existence of the hell realms. But I know after that meditation, I have experienced those in the past. You know, and you could, on the basis of that, one of the reasons for meditating on that also, besides the fear of your own future suffering, is to develop compassion for others that are experiencing that now, what that must be like. So imagining the sufferings of others, all of these, when you do have suffering, if you have a headache, Lama Zopa's general advice is to take half a, what's your favorite, Excedrin, and do half Tonglen. You know, if you can't do all Tonglen, you know, alleviate it a little, but try to utilize that suffering, imagining that you are experiencing the suffering of others, and in so doing, they are free from that, bringing you some sense of Dharma satisfaction. And then imagine sending out your good qualities to them, say your Dharma understanding of how to deal with this, these kinds of problems, your understanding of renunciation and bodhicitta, sending them out to others so that they will be able to cope with that again in the future. One of our teachers, Kirti Senchab Rinpoche, did you guys ever receive teachings from Kirti Senchab Rinpoche? He was the...
I think it was before my time.
Okay.
Robbie, do you know?
He came to Kadam Center once.
Ah. Yeah, he's one of Lama Zopa's, in the later years of Kirti Senchab Rinpoche's life, was one of Lama Zopa's principal gurus. He was a teacher of the Dalai Lama, who passed on various Kalachakra lineages to the Dalai Lama. Great practitioner of Lojong, the training of the mind. Always happy. Whatever happened, Lama Zopa, it's just amazing, you know, even when they're all of the Dorje Shugden controversy or other controversies were coming, always level and happy. Kirti Senchab Rinpoche, near the end of his life, he was diagnosed with, I think it was liver cancer. And the students were very worried about him. And he passed on a message through his translator, Vola, the Greek lady still translating, that he said, you know, all in my life, I've been practicing Tonglen in imagination, taking on the suffering of others. Now I actually have this actual pain and I could actually utilize that. So he was emphasizing how we can do this right now. Even when you have pain right now, it's not only in imagination, utilizing your own pain right now. That's another maybe meaning of directly. Imagine if that is a basis. And using yourself, say, I'm going to experience this suffering to replace the suffering of everyone else. May I, you know, by my experiencing this, bearing with this, and using my Dharma knowledge how to overcome and not to be demolished by this, may I effect the alleviation of other people's suffering. And may I send out my experience, the wisdom that I developed through this, the compassion and so forth I developed through this, to as a gift to others. So perhaps in your teachings or in your own demeanor, you know, in experiencing suffering like this. You understand? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So, yes.
Question?
Yes, Susie.
Thank you. I know at the time of death, Geshe-la has mentioned that we should have a lot of teachings in our mind so that they come easily, and that eventually, maybe you're in pain or other things, you may not be able to practice. And this to me seems like a good training for that.
I think so. Yeah, definitely. The 1:54
p.m.
Oh, my watch just told me the time. Somehow, sometimes when I touch it, there's some feature on these Apple watches. If you touch it, it will tell you the time. I actually accidentally do that sometimes. So, what happened to the gallery view here? Somehow they got up, got rid of seeing all of you. Okay. So, oh, here we go. View gallery. So some years ago, Lama Zopa, in explaining the benefits of Tonglen, told stories of various people who were experiencing great suffering and to whom Rinpoche gave the instructions of Tonglen as a way of purifying the negative karma that was ripening on them at that time, and a way of bringing some relief to their mind. So there was one individual who I think had been diagnosed, maybe some of you will remember, there were several people like this, I think had been diagnosed with AIDS and was in great fear. And Rinpoche told him, I think it was a fellow, to imagine taking on all the suffering of other people's AIDS. And, you know, because he was experiencing it, may that suffice to eliminate the suffering of others. And to do this along with the breathing, I think. And this person, the next day, or two or three days later, he wrote back to Rinpoche or called and said that it had been so moving for this person, even though they didn't have a lot of training in the Dharma and compassion and so forth. Imagine, because he knew what that suffering was like, the fear and maybe the onset of various kinds of symptoms. As he imagined taking on the suffering of others, his tears flowed from his eyes constantly. And he went back for another blood test. After a short time, I think it was only a few days later or a week later or something, and the doctors were like flabbergasted. He'd had a remission of the onset of these, whatever the measure is. Dr. Watkins would know. I don't know if it's the virus that's measured or the some other antibodies or whatever in the body. And Rinpoche said, how long did you do it? And I think he did it for 1 hour. So the incredible karmic impact of doing Tonglen, the alleviation, the purification of negative karma and the accumulation of merit are so immense that sometimes you can actually find some benefit this lifetime. But the real purpose of doing the Tonglen meditation is to be able to develop bodhicitta. So what's the sense there? In the Lama Chopa Puja, that verse that's recited three times, maybe some of you who do the Guru Puja every month at the center or twice a month, or maybe you have a commitment to do every day. That's sometimes thought as the verse on Tonglen, but the actual verse on Tonglen more explicitly comes a few verses later when it says, mounting, giving and taking on the scaffolding of the breath, you know, like thinking of the breath as an aid to be able to utilize Tonglen. Imagine breathing in the suffering of others out of compassion, breathing out your own qualities, your own merits of the three times, your body and possessions with love, because love is what wants to endow others to be happy. Compassion is what wants others to be free from suffering. So imagine taking on their suffering yourself, sending out your good qualities and possessions and virtues and so forth that you would like to think. I've always been working, creating these merits for myself. So imagine dedicating them to others. Mounting the giving and taking on the breath like this. And also utilizing the third aspect in developing bodhicitta. So loving compassion. Loving kindness is one, affection for others and wishing others to have happiness. Compassion is one, wanting others to be free of suffering. But as a result of this, also developing what's called the exceptional thought, which I referred to earlier, that Dalai Lama has begun to translate as universal responsibility, laksam in Tibetan. That's the last step before developing bodhicitta. So you imagine taking on their suffering, sending out good qualities to others, bringing them happiness. And then after some time pausing and recognizing that this alone has not brought about an alleviation of others' suffering. So what can alleviate their suffering? I myself must become a Buddha. I myself must achieve enlightenment to effect these aims of alleviating suffering and setting people into, you know, ultimate Dharma happiness. So understanding more about the purpose of Tonglen can make it much more powerful and effective for you. So when we take on the suffering, it's not taking it on to yourself. You know, you, the conventionally existent person. What you're taking it on to is your self-cherishing thought, which is resilient, resistant rather, to wanting to take on the suffering of others. If someone says, okay, you have the responsibility of cleaning the toilets. Maybe there's some of you, there are probably some of you here who would say, oh, great. But most people would say, you know, I don't want that. Or being responsible for the most unruly person in the community. It's your responsibility. You know, oh, no, not me. Give it to Donna. Give it to Robbie. Give it to someone else. So what you're doing is you're taking the suffering. Part of the initial motivation is to erode the self-cherishing thought. So it's kind of like a triple whammy. Do you know what a double whammy is? You know that expression, win-win. So this is sort of a win-win-win. Out of you're enhancing your compassion. You imagine the suffering of others, and out of compassion, wishing them to be free, and out of with a courageous mind, wanting to yourself to take that and recognize it. In so doing, you will erode the self-cherishing thought. You will cause the self-cherishing attitude, which, remember, is not exactly the same as self-grasping. It's the attitude that has arisen because of constant self-grasping since beginningless time, the attitude that wants our self to be, you know, that we are take care of ourselves, we cherish ourselves more than anything else. So to help to erode that, alleviate that, out of compassion, you know, that's a motivating factor there, and with the recognition that you're not just like a ordinary flagellating yourself or beating yourself senselessly, but you're taking on this onto the self-cherishing thought. You abide with that for some time. Could I do that? Could I stay in the hell realm? Take on the suffering of the hell realms. Take on the suffering of the ignorance of the animal realms, or the lack of finding what's desired of the Prater realm, food, you know, so forth. Taking that on, taking on the cancer of others, the unhappiness of others, the confusion of people now in this election, you know, is still not decided, I guess, unless it's happened in the last hour. Still, you know, credible anger and confusion, taking that on oneself so that others would be free of that. Sending out the solution in terms of your own body, your possessions, and your merits of the three times, which can be enhanced. Imagine sending out these things in the form of wish-fulfilling jewels that in the presence of everyone transform into whatever they need, whatever they desire. whether it be something mundane like, for a teenager, a new iPhone or a guitar or spending money, or to someone who's sick, a nurse, or to someone, even in the Bodhisattvacharya Vatara Shantideva says, may I become pajamas to those who need sleeping garments, may I become food. Whatever is needed for sentient beings, may I become that. So this is leaving the seed in the mind to be able to actually do that in the future. Donna, do you have your hand up? You have a question? Yes.
Yes, there's a question in chat. It is, I struggle with sincerity. I sometimes question, am I being sincere as opposed to self-serving? Do you have any suggestions? Because I have a great desire to be sincere, but I am still self-cherishing.
Yeah, of course. We all are, unless all of you are, which is possible, all of you are Buddhas or Bodhisattvas who are appearing here, sort of thinking and for my benefit so that I can imagine that I'm helping others. Remember I had suggested in the last line, some of the translations, instead of saying secretly, which is in the English translation, the next to the last line, some of the texts say sincerely. So your question is about that. How can you make it sincere? So I think it's a gradual process. You see the benefits of this. And as I mentioned, recognizing one of the benefits is to help to erode your self-cherishing thought. Getting used to being the lowest of all, accepting the defeat, taking the suffering on yourself. Getting used to that, and through your own experience, recognizing through your own experience, realization, that you are benefiting from this. You're becoming more tolerant, more understanding, more empathetic. And then as you progress with other kinds of practices like that, taking on other suffering, it can become more and more sincere. So the motivating factors are to make it sincere and to make the practice powerful is that that you're using these two things of compassion and love. You're taking out of compassion, you're giving with love. You are trying to erode the self-cherishing thought and enhance the mind that cherishes others. You are trying to exchange your attitude of equalizing and exchanging your attitude of cherishing yourself. So with that kind of knowledge and recognizing that you're not punishing yourself, you're punishing the self-cherishing thought. Well, sometimes when Rinpoche gives explanation of this practice, when Namazopa Rinpoche gives explanation, he says, imagine it coming to your heart chakra, so to speak, where our subtlemost mind resides, which is kind of the location that we often associate with the self. I remember in one teaching, Lama Zopa gave, I can't remember if it was in Copa, maybe it was in France, and he asked, why do we, although the Japanese, other people, when they say me, they sometimes point to the head. Do you know that? Is there anyone Japanese here? But generally, when you say me, you point to the, don't mess with me. You point to the middle of your chest. And Rinpoche asked, why is that? And no one answered. So I timidly said, I think that's because that's where the subtlemost mind resides. That's where the sense, sort of an abiding sense of the self is. And Rinpoche seemed to agree with that. So when we do Tonglen, imagine if you do it with the breathing, you can do it different ways. You can imagine just the suffering coming, or you can imagine as you breathe in, all of that suffering comes in the form of black smoke, which comes and to a black spot or a flame at your heart, which is the self-cherishing thought that starts to extinguish that. Maybe you can do successive inhalations. Of course, you exhale each time, but just mainly talking about the taking, first of all. Taking the suffering of others. And breathe out, of course. Taking the suffering and extinguishing the self-cherishing thought that you yourself are experiencing this. And then in successive breaths, emphasize the exhalation, sending out as having extinguished or diminished the self-cherishing thought. So you have the courage to be able to do so, sending out your body, the actual body itself, or as a servant, as a friend, as a, you know, whatever people need, even as food. You know, Shakyamuni Buddha himself gave his body when he was a bodhisattva to the starving tigress who was on the verge of eating her pups. Sending your merits in the form of realizations to others and teachings and so forth. So how to make more sincere? That's one way, I think. The sincerity of our practice is something that comes about organically. It's not something that just happens, that has to happen immediately at the beginning. As I mentioned in other times, in Dharmakirti's teachings, Dharmakirti meaning the great logician that lived, I'm not sure when exactly, the 6th century or the 5th century in India. In his teachings, when he talked about faith in the Buddha as a perfect teacher, you know, one of the causes of refuge, right, is faith. At least at the beginning, it said that at least you should have hope. If you don't have faith right now, at least hope, you know, like, oh, sometimes you're trying different things. You know, oh, I hope this new gadget works or something like that. At least you can take refuge on the basis of that, but eventually turning into faith. The faith is going to increase. The way that faith increases is not just like, I have to be faithful, you know, forcing yourself to have this kind of mind. But the faith arises when you realize, when you have some insight into the Dharma, especially when you've realized, have some insight into emptiness, selflessness. This particular remedy, the wisdom of emptiness, that is not taught by any other spiritual system other than the Buddha. Christianity talks about the reality of the soul. You know, Hinduism also believes, although the soul we believe is Maya, is still sort of inherently existent and so forth. When you have an insight into emptiness and you realize the Buddha, out of his great compassion, taught this hidden phenomena in such a clear way that we could realize it, that it is so liberating, incredible faith in the Buddha and his teachings arises into the things that are not so easily understood, like karma. You know, a Buddha could say anything, is that if you fish, you get one of the karmic results is to have a hair lip. If you do this, the karmic result will be that and so forth. You might think, oh, he could say anything he wants. It's like some new age evangelist, you know, saying if you give me money, you will become rich, you know, or something like that. Just self-serving. But when you realize, when you have some experience of the Dharma, you develop incredible faith in the Buddha as a teacher and in his teachings, even of these obscure subjects. Because if the Buddha was, unlike any other teacher, taught us this incredibly pure and profound, enlightening wisdom of selflessness and emptiness, why would he have lied about these other things, you know. So that can help with the sincerity also. I think also just, you know, in practicing, as you begin to overcome your self-interest and develop an appreciation for working for the welfare of others, that will naturally arise. Okay. So this verse can be thought of that tonglen, but also when it says both directly and indirectly. So directly could have two meanings. I'm saying here, you actually give, you alleviate other people's suffering now as much as you can. You give the benefit and happiness to others that you can. Or it can mean when you directly have an illness, imagine taking on secretly the suffering of others that have that same sickness. That kind of experience, if you have a headache, next time you have a headache, it's so bad, or toothache, you want to take the pain reliever, as Lama Zopa suggests, maybe take half or quarter and do half tonglen or three quarters tonglen. And imagine that you're enduring this suffering, replacing, you know, taking on the suffering of others, that by your experiencing it, they will be free from this. Okay?
Venerable George?
Yes.
I have a question.
Lily, yeah.
So when you talk about tonglen, I can see the benefit to us. It makes us, enhances our compassion. It helps us let go of the self-cherishing mind and helps promote bodhicitta and eventually Buddhahood. How are we helping others? Are we actually, like, by taking on their suffering, we can't change their karma, correct? Or
so, in general, when we create karma, that only ripens upon ourself. But in some circumstances, when we have created some collective karma with others, say we've created virtue with someone else, and the great practitioners of Tonglen, they say that in those circumstances, the suffering of another person with whom you've created some collective virtue, that you can take on their suffering that can actually alleviate that. So the story that comes to mind always in that regard is the you can find on Alex Berzin's website, I think it used to be anyway, and maybe it's changed, when Serkon Senchab Rinpoche was alive. Serkon Senchab Rinpoche was the Lama that I mentioned a couple of times before, great practitioner. He was one of the Senchab, the debating partners of the Dalai Lama. He was, the Dalai Lama kind of considered him to be his lieutenant, like his Shariputra or Mahamoggallana, who would affect the Dalai Lama's decisions about things. So Senchab Rinpoche was in, I think he was maybe in Spiti or Ladakh, which is near Ladakh, and he was attending some teaching or giving teachings there. The Dalai Lama was being flown to Geneva, Switzerland, to attend some conference, and there was fear that because at the same time Yasser Arafat, you remember these names, Yasser Arafat was also flying to Geneva for some, Palestinian meetings or something, peace negotiations or something. There was worry that the Dalai Lama might be, his safety might be imperiled if there were attacks or something like this. And I think the Dalai Lama's plane was being diverted because of that. And so at that time, Serkon Senchab Rinpoche was in India, in northwest India. And he told, Alex said that he told another monk that he was with, let's do tonglen tonight for the, with respect to the Dalai Lama. Generally, when you do Tonglen, it's said that in general, you can't take on the suffering of your guru, because your understanding, if you're practicing properly, is that the guru is an emanation of the Buddha. So the Buddha has no suffering. But what you can do is take on the suffering of the disciples who may be imperiling the appearance of the guru. You know, if the disciples are arguing or there are problems, sometimes the gurus take the aspect of getting sick and passing away. So you can take on that suffering and send out your virtue to alleviate the unfavorable conditions. So Sirkon Rinpoche, he that evening did Tonglen with his other Geshe. And after, as Alex said, he went to the bathroom to evacuate. This is often done when you know that you're going to die, so that you know that your body is clear. He evacuated his bowels, laid down in the lion posture on his bed, and passed away. And Alex explained that it was understood by the practitioners that Rinpoche had taken on these adverse conditions that were imperiling the safety of the Dalai Lama. And because he had had this karmic relationship of practicing virtuously with the Dalai Lama in so many occasions, that he was able to effect that. There's also situations where some Lama saw someone throwing a stone at a dog. Maybe you've heard this in the Lan Rim, and the stone hit the leg of the dog, and the dog was moaning. And the Lama that was watching this did Tonglen at that point, and suddenly a big bruise appeared on his leg, as though perhaps the dog and he had some karmic relationship in the past that he could take on that suffering. So in general, when you do it, there won't be any change in the other person. You know, their situation, their suffering is not going to be alleviated. And so that's one of the resolutions. When you do Tonglen with the breathing, you imagine at the end of that, I haven't affected any change in the happiness of others. Their suffering is not gone necessarily. Their happiness has not been enhanced. So I must achieve enlightenment in order to bring this about. Your mind has been conditioned through out of compassion and love, wanting to eliminate the self-cherishing thought and to enhance the mind of cherishing others. Your mind has been conditioned to develop that exceptional thought. So, you know, in the stages of developing bodhicitta, we call the seven methods of cause and effect, six causes and one effect. Recalling that all sentient beings, recognizing all sentient beings have been our mother, remembering their kindness, developing the responsibility to repay their kindness, developing great compassion, affectionate love, which not full-fledged love, but sees them as dear, great compassion. And then the sixth cause is this one that we're talking about, exceptional thought. Even out of great compassion, it doesn't change them, you know, taking on their suffering, wishing them to be free. I must achieve enlightenment. I myself will take the responsibility. Then the thought, the effect, the seventh element, the bodhicitta can arise. I must achieve enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. Okay. So this is a good point to take a break. Again, it's 2:30. Like yesterday, let's take a 10-minute break for evacuating your bowels if you're going to do Tonglen pass away, or to have a cup of coffee. And is that okay? Where's Donna? Donna disappeared. Okay. So it's okay. So let's take a break. I'm going to stop my video, and we'll be back at 2:35 in 10 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's Kalisha Schaefer's icon there is, I don't know what that is. She's talking on the telephone or something. So other people have photos, names. Joyful Mind. Oh, which one is that? By Pema Chodron. Yeah, great. Excellent choice of reading. Okay. Is it okay to start? Okay. So, while you're taking your first or last sip of tea, any other questions about the verse we just finished, the seventh verse? I like to say, in short, I will offer directly and indirectly every benefit and happiness to all mothers, secretly taking upon myself all mothers' harms and sufferings. Okay. So interesting, so many ladies. I guess it's not that unusual. Most people at the Dharma courses are usually more women than men. Okay, so we're going to start with the eighth verse, the final verse, the eight verses of Training the Mind. So in Lama Sopa Rinpoche's translation, also, I do not defile all these practices. And even though I don't agree with all the words, I think you should say any of these practices. I do not defile any of these practices with the stains of the superstitions of the eight worldly concerns, and knowing all phenomena to be illusory, without trusting them, I am freed from bondage. So, generally, that if you read commentaries, if you've received teachings on the eight verses, that's the general idea. In the first part, the first half of that is talking about the stains of the, Rinpoche translates, superstitions of the eight worldly concerns. That's generally how people understand that. But the Tibetan actually says, it says, Dedak Kunkyang, also those, meaning those practices, Chuge ki tokpa dima masakpa, not defiled by stains of conceptions of the eight dharmas. That's literally what it says. The Rinpoche takes tokpa, usually means conceptions, as superstitions. But there is, as I'll mention here, we'll go through that sequence first of all. But there are other commentaries that take a different meaning to the eight dharmas, conceptions of the eight dharmas, because it's well known in Nargarjuna's teachings on emptiness. He talks about four conceptions of reality, inherently coming and inherently existent, coming and going, rising and falling, and different things like this. There's a set of eight. And some commentators say that that's referring to, without conceptions of these eight wrong views of emptiness, which implies a meditative equipoise on emptiness. Because the last two lines are talking about what's called the post-meditation on emptiness, seeing all phenomena as illusory. You know, you've received teachings, some teachings on emptiness, right? So generally we say in the meditative session on emptiness, you try to develop what's called a space-like meditation on emptiness, almost a little bit like the clarity of the mind that we're practicing, right? kind of Mahamudra meditation. So in that meditative session, you've realized that the object that you're focusing on, like the inherently existent, the appearance of the inherently existent I, is just that, is an appearance. It doesn't exist at all, like a reflection is devoid of the person that you're imagining in the reflection, or the echo is devoid of the of an animate being that's creating it. It's actually reflecting off of that. In that meditative session, you realize the emptiness of the phenomena directly, or can be conceptually, indirectly, so forth, but you realize that. And in post-meditation, by the power of that understanding, when things appear to you so real, you know, and even your own ego identity seems so real, you kind of chuckle, scratch your head and say, oh, like a dream. It seems so real, but it doesn't exist that way. And it's like an illusion. So that's called the illusion-like meditation on emptiness. So in at least one teaching, I think a couple of teachings, the Dalai Lama he's given so many times teachings on the eight verses of training the mind. In some of those teachings, he said, you know, today I'm going to explain this from the point of view of the first two lines referring to the meditative state of emptiness, space-like meditation, because simply realizing phenomena are illusory, like in the last two lines, how do you know that they're illusory unless you've realized emptiness, space-like meditation on emptiness? So naturally, there is that kind of, oh, Barbara's cat. naturally, there is that kind of progression that seems obvious. So, but we're going to explain, first of all, we're going to explain it the way it's traditionally done. And the way that I think of it is that the first two lines is kind of like a very skillful, clever double entendre, can you say? I'm not sure if that's exactly the right word. It implies both. May none of these practices be compromised or defiled by the stains of conceptions of the eight dharmas, meaning the eight worldly dharmas, and then understood by that also by the wording, because it doesn't say mundane dharmas. Usually in Tibetan we say jikten chuge. Jikten means samsaric or worldly or mundane. So we say the eight worldly dharmas, jikten chuge, or we say the eight mundane dharmas or eight mundane concerns. Here the dharma, in that sense, when we talk about the eight worldly dharmas, the meaning of that is in contradistinction to the holy dharma, the sad dharma, the excellent dharma that actually holds us up from suffering. The worldly dharmas or mundane dharmas are what we think hold us up from suffering. You know, desire to have possessions, desire to be, to have pleasure of the senses, desire to be free of criticism, desire to be loved, and so forth. And then the opposites of those making up, each of them have, you know, desire to have possessions, desire to be free from losing possessions or not getting things. Each of them have a pair. So this verse doesn't use the word jigten or mundane in the Dharma, so that leads to some ambiguity there. Generally, the eight conceptions of about dharmas is Nargarjuna's texts, which all of the great Tibetan scholars know. In fact, often are mentioned, and when the Dalai Lama gives teachings on emptiness, wisdom, often that verse is mentioned at the very beginning. That talks about these eight dharmas, which are wrong conceptions. So let's first of all talk about it the conventional way. So up till now, all of these practices that we've talked about, the first seven verses, you can try to practice sincerely. Like one of the questions is how you can increase your sincerity. But if your mind is still grasping to the appearance of this life as paramount, you're overcome by that, you will inevitably fall prey to desiring, you know, your practice to bring about your, enhance your reputation, that others will praise you. You'll hear sweet ego-pleasing words. You might be remunerated with offerings, you know, so you have the possessions, pleasure of the senses and so forth, pleasure of the mind. What was I saying? Pleasures, possessions, fame and sweet, ego-pleasing sounds and words. So if your mind has any of these motivations, not the holy, you know, a pure motivation, you will be creating what's called striped karma, you know, like a rope that has one strand of rope is white, one strand is black. Do you ever see those kind of ropes, or red or something? So it's kind of like you're creating some virtuous karma along with karma that's defiled by your wish to obtain these eight worldly dharmas, eight worldly concerns are motivated by that. So Atisha said in some of his teachings, and Rinpoche mentioned many years ago in the first book he wrote about meditation that I don't know if still exists, the wish-fulfilling golden sound of the Mahayana, something like that, that used to be used at Kopan courses. Does that still exist? Did that ever get published? Anyone know? Anyway, in there, here's a quote from Atisha saying that any action motivated by the eight worldly concerns, eight worldly dharmas, creates the karma to be born in the lower realms. It sounds like, whoa. I've asked some Kopan Geshis in the earlier days, ones that were still young, and they didn't think that was possible. You know, they thought that couldn't do that. Having those kind of thoughts couldn't throw you into the lower realms. But this is what Atisha said, very pure practitioner. So even if the virtue that you create by practicing the first seven virtues creates virtuous karma, if it's defiled by motivation of the eight worldly dharmas, when that virtue ripens itself, it's going to have along with it some compromising factors. You may, maybe instead of being wealthy, you receive notice that you've inherited some money, but there's a court case and you never get it, or something like that. Or, you know, someone praises you, but then immediately, like in the politics today, other people say, oh no, you're not praiseworthy at all. So one wants to avoid compromising these activities with the thoughts of the eight worldly concerns. That makes sense? That's the general way that verse is understood.
I have I don't know if it's a question or a comment. I guess it's a question.
Okay.
It seems to me from what you've been talking about that, and especially this last point you made, that the practitioner of these eight verses, it sounds to me like it's better if you pick one, the one that you feel there's more sincerity or more capability to do it sincerely. And this is the part where I'm not sure, is because you are doing it with more or less pure intent, that is the actual cause for, you know, developing better conditions for you to continue to practice, you know, like your needs, you know, your material needs are little by little met, you know, like food and clothing and shelter. Because I've been reflecting on these things, on these verses, and particularly the first one, like if you want to do it like hardcore, you know, like really get really, you know, jump into it. It sounds like you have to let go as much as you can, you know, of many assumptions, you know, many beliefs, cultural and if you want gender-like, or if you, and also expected behavior, you know, from you to other people and from other people to you, you know, to your children. I mean, so that is pretty scary. I mean, so, because eventually, you know, you start little by little, and that's what I think you do. You start little by little, but the whole point that, and I see from here, is that eventually you will at some point reach about where you really have let go of many of these assumptions, especially the ones related to self-cherishing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So, yeah. So, but it, like, actually, these teachings on training the mind, developing bodhicitta and so forth, were first of all secret, right? They weren't exposed to the public. What was they're sort of like difficult to actualize and sort of intimidating, as you're recognizing at first. So what was first given were the general presentation of the Lan Rim, the stages of the path, in the same way that we try to do a glance meditation every day of all the stages, even though we may be at a particular point. In the same way, once you get to the point when you, when these teachings are appropriate from you, for you, you want to go through all of them, even though there might be one or two of them that are more authentic for you. All of them are organically related. Okay, so that's one thing. And you're welcome to just to put emphasis on one of them, but to be aware of all of them in the same way that we do glance meditation on the Lan Rim. Like at the end of Guru Puja, do you guys know the glance meditation at the end of that goes through all of the stages? You may still be in the practice of the person of initial scope or intermediate scope, but you still study the meditations on the higher parts. And in that glance meditation, there are many verses on the training of the mind, but that's come after a foundation when you've developed some kind of confidence in the teachings and so forth. So this is that's the traditional explanation of the first two lines. Yes, Donna.
Yes, there's a question in chat. If all phenomena are illusory, then all sentient beings and all dharma are one, but we refer to them as separate because of the illusion?
Let me see the word illusion here. Chukungyumar, as illusory. Actually, Rinpoche says, and knowing all phenomena to be illusory. I don't know who the scribe was. Did you write that? Can't you hear me?
That was a question in chat.
No, but Barbara's going like this to her ears. I'm not sure.
I confess.
Oh, you wrote the question. Okay. No, I was saying who translated Rinpoche's translation here. It says, and knowing all phenomena to be illusory. Actually, the Tibetan says, knowing all phenomena as illusory. That's actual Tibetan. And in Rinpoche would agree, in other contexts also, we don't say that phenomena are illusions. We say they are like illusions. So what does that mean? Illusions and reflections and so forth seem to be one thing, whereas they are actually devoid of the reality that we're attributing to them. Like, say, dreams. When you wake up, when you're in the dream, I had some very vivid dreams last night. Maybe I didn't get much sleep as I was waking up. And I was really, even after I woke up, I said, oh, where am I? Am I there? You know, it seems so real, but the seeming reality of the dream is like an illusion. It's like a dream. It doesn't really exist the way that it appears. So it's not saying that all phenomena are illusory, although the English translation here, whether it was the scribe or Rinpoche's, his sort of Tibetan English, usually would say, and knowing all phenomena as illusory, that means like illusions. So from the point of view of Lama Tsongkhapa in the Gelugpa tradition, we say that phenomena do have, the appearances due to our karma, do have a conventional existence and a consistency. And that is one of the things that we revere, that the law of cause and all of these appearances are due to the law of cause and effect, the infallibility. If you create negative karma, you will experience appearances which are consistent with that, that is unpleasant appearances. They are mere appearances upon which we superimpose some kind of reality, and we get heartbroken if Brad Pitt has been stabbed with a spear when he's playing, you know, Paris of Troy or something like that, or, you know, soap operas, we get caught up. They're just mere appearances, but they are consistent. And the Buddhas, who know that phenomena do not exist the way that they appear, still have compassion for sentient beings, because you might say, why do the Buddhas have compassion? The suffering that sentient beings are having are just illusory, right? They're like illusions. Well, sentient beings don't know they're illusions, and they're frightened and worried and suffer as a result of them. So therefore, the Buddhas, you know, aim to alleviate that suffering. So all phenomena are said to be of one taste in emptiness. That means all of these appearances to our mind, the appearance of the self, the appearance of our own mind, the appearance to the mind, the senses, sight, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations, mental phenomena, all of them have their own individual appearances, distinct colors. In case of things that have color, what do we say? Like reflections, they are clear and complete. They like rainbows, they are they display themselves in individual, distinct colors and so forth, aspects. And like the appearance of the moon in a lake, they are to be apprehended without superimposition or deprecation. So deprecation means that they don't exist at all. They do have a conventional existence, but they're devoid of the reality that we attribute to them. In meditative equipoise, on emptiness, all of these things are of the same taste. They're devoid of the reality that we attribute to them. That's what's meant by same taste. Although they have different colors and shapes and appearances to the mind, some pleasant, unpleasant, all of those things are the same in being devoid of the reality that we're attributing to them. Just like a reflection, there are different things in the reflection, but they're all devoid of being the actual sweater or your face, or they're actually, they appear to be that way, but they're devoid of that. Okay? Does that make sense? Maybe not.
Thank you.
Okay. So one way of interpreting the first two lines is that with none of these, that means practices, the previous seven, compromised, you could say, or defiled with the stains of the conceptions of the eight dharmas, and you can understand that meaning the eight worldly dharmas, but the counterpoint to that, like I said, the double entendre, and some of the commentaries point this out explicitly, they don't even mention the eight worldly dharmas, I think it's kind of both, is that all of these phenomena, all of these practices that we've done, if you conceive of them as being real, they do have an appearance. You do, you yourself make charity, you yourself do Tonglen, you yourself accept the defeat, you just, you yourself cherish others, this appearance. And in so doing, you do create the karma to evolve and have different appearances in the future, but they are all actually devoid of the conceptions of these eight misconceptions of reality. So this is from when the Dalai Lama has given commentary on this verse when he says, today I'm going to explain it from the point of view of the first two lines, meaning may all these phenomena, with none of these practices compromised by conceptions of the eight inherently existent kinds of ways of existing that Nagarjuna mentions at the beginning of his text. It was kind of encompassing, kind of meaning to encompass all of the ways that we can misinterpret phenomena. That's talking about the meditative equipoise on emptiness, the what's called space-like meditation on emptiness. Without an understanding of emptiness, His Holiness says, you know, he says, if you look at the last two lines, it's kind of funny. He says, if it's talking about by knowing all phenomena to be illusory, may I be freed from the bondage of attachment without clinging. How do you have that understanding that they're illusory unless you've actually ascertained that they're empty? Those two things have to go together. So then the last two lines, so Rinpoche translates, and knowing all phenomena to be illusory without trusting them, I am free from bondage. The word that he's saying, trusting, is shenmei. Shenpa in the philosophical literature refers to strong kind of grasping at inherent existence. Sort of like, I could say trusting. I guess you could say trusting. That's, I've never seen it translated that in that way in the philosophical literature. It's usually talking about without the adherence to phenomena. Because when we talk about grasping to true existence, the wrong view of the ignorance that grasps to true existence, you know, you see another person or you a tree or a fence or something, and you're not satisfied with merely labeling it as fence or face or person or tree. Your mind, through habituation over numberless lifetimes in the past, as soon as something appears to you, you superimpose as though there is a real thing existing there from its own side, that there is a real tree, a real person, and even inner phenomena like yourself. It appears there in your mind. It appears from habituation over numberless lifetimes to be existing from its own side, really there. Not just the name you give to a bunch of parts, you know, the basis of imputation. So without grasping at them, without adhering to them as inherently existent, knowing all phenomena as illusory, may I be liberated from the bondage. May I be liberated from bondage. So what that means is the bondage of cyclic existence. When we talk about taking rebirth again and again in cyclic existence, it's as though we're chained within that due to our conceptions about the self-identity and the existence of other phenomena, holding those things to be really existent the way that they appear, not having understood emptiness. So we're bound to the, you know, the prison of cyclic existence, and we're trapped in the ocean of cyclic existence. So this verse, I like to think of the first two lines as kind of being referring to both, you know, without being defiled with the conceptions of the eight worldly concerns that are going to cause your any of these activities to be mixed karma, not to be pure karma, pure dharma. And also by understanding without defiling any of these activities by conceiving them to be truly existent, inherently existent. Then, because the second line ends with the word shing, which means and, not defiling any of these with conceptions of the eight dharmas, and by knowing all phenomena as illusory, without grasping, without adhering to them as inherently existent, may I be free from bondage, the bondage to cyclic existence. So in this regard, in Geshe Chekwa's commentary to this verse, although his commentary seems to be talking about the eight, even Tripten Jima translated as the eight mundane concerns, and in the commentary, Geshe Chekwa at the beginning says, when tainted with the mundane concerns, such as the desire to be perceived by others as praiseworthy, etc., we fall under the influence of the eight mundane concerns, and our pursuits become those of self-interest. So that's what he's saying. But he gives some quotations to explain that, and the quotation actually affirms the other interpretation of this verse's meaning, that phenomena are empty. This quotation says, so among these empty phenomena, which can mean that the appearances to the mind or your practices, what is there to gain or lose? I think this is a quotation from Shantideva's Bodhisattvacharyavatara. Once you've realized emptiness, that phenomena are devoid of inherent existence, what is there to gain or lose? You know, of the mundane, the mundane concerns will fall away having realized emptiness. So among these empty phenomena, what is there to gain or lose? You know, like did in a romance on the TV or an action show, did they actually kill the enemy? If you were back there at the filming, you see the film crew say, okay, cut. And the guy who's been blasted apart, you see, it just takes off the fake blood and everything like that. It's illusory, right? So among these empty phenomena, what is there to gain or lose? Who provides you with what service? And who subjects you to insults? So realizing emptiness is an ultimate solution to the eight worldly concerns. From whence do pleasure and pain arise? What is there to be sad or joyful about? You know, talking about worldly excitement and joy and worldly sadness and so forth. And further, he quotes another from a different place in the Bodhisattvacharyavatara, I think. or maybe this is an unknown quotation, that all things are just like space, like illusions, I for one shall accept. So when reciting these verses and trying to put them into practice, this last verse is very rich. We can understand it as reminding us from the beginning not to let any of the practices that we do, let's say the first seven are kind of the method side, my right hand, right side. The last verse is mainly talking about wisdom, but in one interpretation, it's also talking about none of these defiled with the eight worldly concerns or eight worldly dharmas, but in a more profound sense, with none of them defiled with any kind of conception that phenomena are inherently existent. And then in post-meditation, realizing them all, therefore, to be like illusions. As a result of that, not grasping, not adhering to phenomena as inherently existent, I will be freed from the bondage of cyclic existence. Usually when we talk about bondage here, it's not talking about those things where someone is bound up and they're whipped and something like that for their own pleasure or something. Not that kind of bondage, not being bound in prison. But here is talking about bondage to cyclic existence, the bondage that we are experiencing now, always experiencing sadness again and again, sometimes getting excited, but it never lasting, never being satisfied. Satisfying, that's the bondage of cyclic existence. So, in order to really actualize this last verse, just like the other ones, takes some time. This is kind of like a great introduction to the practices of the bodhisattvas. You know, training of the mind to develop bodhicitta, conventional bodhicitta. The last verse especially emphasizing ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom of emptiness, so that none of your actions are compromised by conceiving them as inherently existent. Then Lama Zopa has his own comment on colophon there, but the colophon in the eight verses, let me just read to you for completion here. Oh yeah, usually the colophon is very short there, I think. You know what a colophon is, right? Not a telephone. Colophon is a verse at the end that says who wrote it, where, in what circumstances, who requested it sometimes, and so forth. So in the commentary, the actual eight verses, just the root verses, had a very short thing. It said it was taught by Langri Tangpa Dorje Senge. That was another one of his names, Dorje Senge, Vajra Lion, Langri Tangpa. Geshe, This was taught by him. That's the only colophon in the root verses. But in Chekhova's commentary to the eight verses, it was one of the first ones. There may have been some that we don't know about. This commentary on the eight verses of the Bodhisattva Langri Tangpa was composed by Chekhova Yeshe Dorje. So Geshe Chekhova, his ordination name was Yeshe Dorje. This commentary on the root verses constitutes a profound instruction on mind training of the mind. Please strive in this. May its realization arise in the hearts of all. So I did not give a full transmission of everything Geshe Chekhova commented, but use that for orientation. So let's open up to some discussion again. Does anyone have any questions about these last two verses or the last verse in particular? Susie has her hand up.
Tell me if this is something that you don't want to go into. I had found the verse in dependent origination. There is no ceasing, no arising, no annihilation, no permanence, no coming, no going, no separateness, and no sameness. Are those the eight that you're referring to as far as a second interpretation?
I believe so. Where did you find that quotation? Is that does
oh, it, in the flame of bodhicitta. I'm taking a course from the Nalanda Institute. So, it but
The one in the Nalanda in France or the Nalanda
in New Delhi.
In New Delhi. Okay, so I know the Geshe who runs that. Yeah, that's probably those. That's probably the verse from the beginning of Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom. And okay. So those are called these eight dharmas. So in other words, all of these are dependent arisings. All of mm-hmm. these coming and going, enhancing, degenerating, and so forth. They are not inherently existent the way that our mind apprehends them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that can, if you get a chance, I think in, I don't have the text right here, but Jeffrey Hopkins' famous text called Meditation on Emptiness.
I have that. Yeah.
You can find Nagarjuna's quotation in there. And as I mentioned, many times when His Holiness teaches, well, it's generally when he teaches, he often, that's one of the verses that is recited by everyone. Most of the monks know that, and lay people know that. There are a couple of, like the preface to the Abhisamaya Alamkara, the ornament of clear realizations. There's some verses there. The verse at the beginning of Pramanavartika on the explanation of what logic is and so forth. There's a verse about how the Buddha is an authentic teacher and so forth. And then this verse from Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom about emptiness.
I didn't want to take you off path. No. I just wanted to make sure that that's what you were referring to.
I believe so. Yeah, I believe that's
something
the verse
like that. Okay.
That's been talked about. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. How about the rest of you? Anyone else that has some? Question, doubt, comment. Okay. So I'm going to, just for auspiciousness, they may have some other thoughts. I'm going to again recite these eight verses as Rinpoche has translated, or at least the current translation by the FPMT that I have. There are always additions, tweaking. As I mentioned, that I think sometimes the grammar has a couple of small errors in it. I'll recite that first and then recite how I often think of them. The eight verses of thought transformation. Determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I hold them most dear at all times. Wherever I am and whoever I am with, I always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. In all actions, I examine my mental continuum, and the minute a delusion arises, since it endangers myself and others, I forcefully confront and avert it. Whenever I see sentient beings who are wicked in nature, and overwhelmed by negative actions and heavy suffering. I hold such rare ones dear as if I had found a precious treasure. When out of envy, others mistreat me with abuse, insults, and the like, I accept defeat and offer the victory to them. With someone whom I have benefited and in whom I have great hope gives me terrible harm, I regard them as my spiritual, my virtuous friend. In short, both directly and indirectly, I offer every happiness and benefit to all my mothers. I secretly take upon myself all their harms and sufferings. And finally, also, I do not defile all these practices by the stains of the superstitions of the eight worldly concerns. And by knowing all phenomena to be illusory without trusting them, I am free from bondage. So I'll just say them again as I often say them. Responsible to obtain the greatest aim for all sentient beings who excel the wish-fulfilling gem, I will cherish them at all times. With whoever I interact, I will always consider myself to be the very lowest of all, and sincerely cherish others as supreme. Vigilant of my mind stream throughout all actions, whenever afflictions arise endangering myself and others, I will confront and avert them without delay. Whenever I see beings of bad character, oppressed by great suffering and obsessed with negative actions, I will cherish them as a precious treasure, which is so difficult to acquire. I will practice to accept defeat and offer the victory to others, such as when abused by others out of jealousy and so forth. When someone I have benefited and in whom I have great hopes gives me unjust harm, I will practice to see them as my holy friend, holy spiritual friend. In short, directly and indirectly, I will aim to bring about every benefit and happiness to all mothers, secretly taking upon myself all the harms and sufferings of mother sentient beings. With none of these defiled or compromised by conceptions of the eight dharmas and by seeing all phenomena as illusory, free of adhering to them, may I be liberated from bondage. So that concludes the eight the transmission of the eight verses, commentary on the eight verses. And I thought I'd mention a little bit more. When one is practicing these, you might like to, in order to develop some real taste and to maybe to enhance your sincerity about them, this is what some of you were asking, you can do this practice with each of the verses with respect to a meditational deity, like Avalokiteshvara. I think the first time I received this commentary, I'm not sure we Lama Zopa, I think we received it after or before receiving the Avalokiteshvara initiation at Kopan, but when I've received it in other circumstances, sometimes you imagine Avalokiteshvara on your head, and after saying each verse, you imagine, you know, almost like saying the verse as a request to Avalokiteshvara, imagine from his heart, light and nectar flows down into you, eliminating, first of all of the hindrances in your mind that prevent you from making these realizations, from having these authentic, sincere thoughts. And then after having been cleansed by this white nectar, imagine golden nectar comes down, bringing you the blessings of making the realizations. Just like it, and when we do a Lanrim meditation with the merit field, we imagine first white light come and white light and nectar coming. First of all, purifying the obscurations in our mind that prevent us from making the realizations. We become, in a sense, a suitable vessel, you know, having eliminated the obstacles. And then golden light coming and golden light and nectar coming and bringing the blessings of the inspiration to be able to actually make those realizations. You could either do that before or after saying the verses. Sometimes in some of the commentaries I've received, the deity that's used is Amitabha. Amitabha Buddha, again, on the top of one's head. And saying the verse is in the sense of a request to Amitabha and imagining light and nectar coming down, cleansing you, and then light and nectar coming down and bringing you the blessings from the Buddha to make those realizations. And of course, all of that becomes more powerful if you're practicing these what we call Kriya Tantra, the action Tantra visualizations, as I'll mention tomorrow night in the talk that I'll give on for discovering Buddhism. Dr. Don had admonished me after the first class. I didn't mention how to utilize these Kriya Tantra visualizations in meditating. So I'll mention that again tomorrow. Recognizing the appearance of Avalokiteshvara or the appearance of Amitabha or whatever deity one is using, Manjushri or whatever, and recognizing that as an appearance to your mind, which is in one nature with your own guru. You know, your own guru appearing as Avalokiteshvara or Manjushri or Amitabha. And because of that integration with the practice of guru devotion, seeing your own teacher as one with the meditational deity, that's one of the quick ways to make realizations. Yes, Donna.
Yes, Honorable George, there are two requests that came to me in chat. One of them is for a copy of your the version that you use in your practice, the slightly different translation that you use. Another one is a request for a brief empowerment to use a meditational deity for this practice.
So I can write down and send to you, which hopefully you can distribute to anyone who's interested, my translation. I'll do maybe by Tuesday. Tomorrow I have the class for discovering Buddhism, so I might not get around to it tonight. I haven't done my prayers yet, so I have to do that. I'll try to get that to you by Tuesday. In terms of an empowerment, generally, to give an empowerment, one has to have received initiation and to receive permission either from the deity or from your own guru. to give empowerments. It's not just, you know, it's not just something you do the retreat and you decide I'm going to give that or something like that. I think the very first Westerner who gave empowerments was, I can't remember his name. I was one of the disciples of Lama Yeshe who did a 3-year retreat under the tutelage of Kempchi Ling Rinpoche. And after doing that long 3-year Yamantaka retreat, Ling Rinpoche said, oh, now you can give that retreat. Now, I've done some retreats. I haven't done I've done retreats of Avalokiteshvara and others, but I haven't done, and Manjushri, but not Amitabha. But I haven't been empowered by the deities or by guru to give empowerments. So that's right now, that's out of the question. I believe, I'm not sure, I heard maybe Lama Sopa Rinpoche had given permission to Venerable Rabina to give Vajrasattva empowerment. Is that right? Did she give it? Donna?
I don't know.
Okay. I'm not sure. But in general, much better if you could request Geshe-la. I know Geshe-la generally has not given at your center, that's, to my understanding, hasn't given any tantric empowerments, but maybe with a fervent request to give something very safe and wholesome, like the Avalokiteshvara empowerment he might give, or the next time that Lama Zopa Rinpoche comes, or one of the other gurus of Geshe Gelug, maybe the Lama who, the abbot, former abbot of Sarah, who gave the teaching this morning, could even give over Zoom. You know, it's possible. His Holiness, I remember Lama Yeshe, near the end of his life, he gave a white Tara empowerment over the telephone before the internet was around. And His Holiness has said sometime in some of the empowerments he's given that you can receive empowerment that way. I know Kirti Senchab Rinpoche, who I've alluded to a couple of times, also said that it is possible to receive empowerment that way. So you might ask Geshe-la if he could arrange for that, if he doesn't want to do himself. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. At least.
I don't know if this is the right place to ask this question, but because of what you've just said, I'm still totally confused about the difference between initiation and empowerment.
So generally, as I understand, these two words are interchangeable translation for the Tibetan word wangkur. Wang means power. Kur means bestowing. So it means to bestow power, which in earlier days, people generally called them initiations, like a initiation of Vajrasattva or something like that. But the word empowerment maybe is a little more the flavor of that Tibetan word, because in mirroring or mimicking the empowerment of a king or queen, there is a ritual bath often, and then there's a crown, and the scepter is given, and other symbols of the authority, and imagining the, you know, in some of the empowerments, imagining the divine deity entering into the monarch so that they can, you know, have some imagined connection with virtue and so forth. So in mirroring on that, also in the Indian royal tradition, there were ceremonies in which the royalty was given sovereignty. There would be a crown. There would be a bath, first of all, like the vase initiation. there would be a crowning, the crown, a crown empowerment, and then the Vajra empowerment, which is like the scepter, and the bell empowerment, talking about the speech of the individual, and then a name empowerment. Finally, you are named sovereign, you know, so and so, and then then elaborations of that. So the two words initiation and empowerment are meant to imply the same thing. There are some other kinds of rituals that are done that give you permission to do various practices. One of the terms in Tibetan, I don't know the Sanskrit, is jenang. You receive a jenang. Jenang literally means subsequent permission. That once having received that ritual, you are permitted to do certain visualizations or recite certain mantras that might have other restrictions upon them. Sometimes people would say that that's kind of like an initiation, but they're not full empowerments into the practice of those tantric practices, those deities. Generally, an empowerment, as I mentioned in the last Monday, and we'll continue tomorrow night, empowerment is kind of like an introduction to the deity, sort of what do you call it? When you introduce two friends, oh, this is so-and-so, this is so-and-so, you're being introduced to the deity and the surrounding entourage of the deity, mandala, through the your common friend being the guru, your guru appearing as a deity and requesting the deity's indulgence that you are now in the presence of the guru, you are now being empowered to do these practices. It's said that without that kind of introduction, that kind of empowerment, through a guru who has actually done the retreat of the deity, done all of the requirements of it, mantras and so forth, and done the final fire puja and so forth, and has permission from their guru or the deity to give that initiation, without that, it's improper to actually practice yourself, visualizing yourself as a deity, but you can visualize the deities in front. You can visualize Avalokiteshvara or Tara and so forth, Manjushri, all of these different deities, and recite their mantras. Some of the things that I said, the permission, subsequent permission, the jenang, if you receive that, even though that's not a full initiation, your recitation of the mantras and your visualization of the deities become heavier in karma. They create more virtue, having received that permission. Does that help a little bit?
Yes, thank you. So may I just recap? So when you receive an initiation or an empowerment,
yeah, meaning the same thing. Yeah,
it's because you have received a direct teaching or a demonstration of dharma or ritual from a qualified teacher.
That's not what's meant by an empowerment or an initiation. When we're talking about empowerment or initiation in the realm of tantra, it means a particular ceremony or ritual in which you are in the presence of a guru, and in their presence, in prelude to the empowerment to you, you're maybe the one of many people, or might be just for you. In their presence, they have previously, say before the empowerment, they have previously that very day re-entered the mandala of that deity and renewed their tantric vows. They visualize their self as a deity and call upon the actual omniscient mind to appear in that deity, in this environment, and to bless you, sort of like introducing you to the practice in various steps. So just receiving a general Dharma teaching is not considered an initiation or an empowerment. I know there was one fellow in Europe. I can't remember what his name is. He'll come to me. That if he gave refuge ceremony, he said that he was now their almost like their tantric guru or something like that. So generally taking refuge or receiving vows, those are ceremonies. They're generally not called initiations or empowerments, right? If you take the lay vows or the bodhisattva vows, or you take refuge with a lama, those are rituals or ceremonies that leave the seed to be able to be successful in those practices. To take refuge, you don't have to take a refuge ceremony, a refuge ritual. In fact, you know, the main causes of refuge are to have a fear of suffering, of cyclic existence, or fear of the lower realms at least, and at least a hope that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can protect you in some way. Hopefully, actual faith that the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can protect you. You don't have to do a ritual. If you do the ritual, you know, with a guru, and sometimes they give you a Dharma name or something like that, that can leave a greater impact in your mind. Now I've made the decision to become a Buddhist, but that's not necessary at all. Also, the Bodhisattva vow, the Bodhisattva ceremony, or where, you know, the Dalai Lama gives so-called Bodhisattva vows, a wishing vow or engaging vow. You can actually take that vow imagining the Buddha in space in front of you. In fact, once you've taken the vow, because it's inevitable that you will have broken some of the limbs of the subtle practices, it's considered appropriate, maybe even necessary, to take the Bodhisattva vow again every day. Maybe not in the large, elaborate ceremony that you might take with a teacher, simply by reciting the one verse, like a teacher wrote. You probably say in class, Sangye Chudang Soki Chognang La, Changchu Bardu Dagni Kapsuchi, Dagi Jinsuk Kipe Sonam Ki, Drola Penchir Sangye Drupasho. I go for refuge to the Buddha Dharma, the Supreme Assembly, meaning the Mahayana Assembly of Bodhisattvas. Sangye Chudang Soki Chognang La, until I'm enlightened, Changchu Bardu Dagni Kapsuchi. I go for refuge to them. Due to my practice of the perfections of generosity and so forth, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. That one verse is sufficient to renew your Bodhisattva vows every day. So you don't have to take an initiation. Those are not called initiations or empowerments. Generally, that the word initiation or empowerment are reserved for these tantric practices.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
Venerable George, there's another question in chat. I have learned to view these eight verses like exercise, just as running or lifting weights makes you healthy and strong. Repetition of these verses is exercising the mind, training the mind, resulting in a correct worldview. And is that a disrespectful understanding?
Well, I think that's it. You know, there are two versions of the verses, original and subsequent. Original verses ended with a word that kind of said, may this be. And the subsequent presentations, the last word of the last line was lap, which means I will train. So you could say, you could think of these as trainings or exercises of the mind. I will train, making a sincere declaration that I will train, I will practice to do these things. Even reciting the words alone will leave some imprint in the mind to encounter them again in the future. But if you don't have any, if you don't follow up, if you don't actually do anything, you know, to follow those practices, you know, it's good, still good. It'll leave some imprint to perhaps encounter them again. But even at that time, you won't necessarily be impelled to practice them immediately. So try to put some effort into actualizing the meaning of the words. Same thing with the Lam Rim. You can become a Lam Rim scholar, the stages of the path, to know all these things, but you never really apply it to your own mind. This is what the Buddha referred to the erudite people at his time who were scholarly in the Hindu tradition, or even his own followers who were knew all the words and the meanings. That's helpful. That's called that's part of upholding the scriptural doctrine. We say there's two kinds of teachings of the Buddha, or doctrine of the Buddha: the scriptural and the realizational doctrine. Scriptural doctrine means the words that you can read and understand, and having memorized those or being able to know some of them and recite them from reading, that's called transmitting the scriptural doctrine. Upholding the scriptural doctrine means memorizing the words and explaining them correctly, how to understand those words to others. You don't even have to have the realization to uphold the scriptural doctrine, the scriptural dharma. And the realizational dharma means the actual, not just the words or the meaning of the words understood, but actually developing the fruit of those practices, the realizations. You know, not just explaining impermanence and death to others, but having an experience of that in your own mind stream, knowing, realizing, having the wisdom that understands how things are momentarily changing and how we will all eventually die. Not just knowing, realizing that has a great impact. That's one way to uphold the realizational dharma. Another way is simply to keep vows. If you have the vows of a lay person, or the vows of a monk or nun, or the bodhisattva vows or tantric vows, merely keeping those vows is called upholding the realizational dharma. And you might be confused because it sounds like that might be superficial. That's not like a realization. But because ethics or morality, the keeping of vows, is the basis for concentration and wisdom, actual realizations, it's said that keeping your vows is an example of upholding the realizational dharma, realizational doctrine. So in many dedication prayers at the end, there's a verse that says something to the effect that, due to these merits, may I be able to uphold the scriptural and realizational doctrine. Like Lama Zopa Rinpoche is a holder or upholder of the teachings. It means he's received transmission of various teachings, and he is qualified, having practiced and understood them correctly, he's able to give oral transmission of that, lung. That's called upholding the scriptural dharma. And of course, if he's practiced those things, most of those things he's practiced and realized, he's also upholding the realizational dharma of those practices. if you uphold both, if you have realization and a correct understanding of the words and their meaning, and you've realized them, then obviously the transmission, even transmitting the words to others, becomes much more powerful. Yes, Barbara.
I was going to say, and the way to internalize it so that it's automatic is through meditation. Meditation.
Both. Yeah. Generally, you know, when we talk about the development of wisdom, understanding, and insight, we say there's a wisdom that first arises through hearing or reading something. You know, someone transmits to you, they say, the 8 verses are this. It's sort of transmission of the words. There's a certain wisdom that arises from hearing or reading. If, in addition to that, you try to delve into the meaning of the words, you know, the implication of these things, you contemplate it, you have a deeper kind of wisdom that arises about that subject called the wisdom arisen from contemplation. So the first wisdom is a wisdom of hearing, or call it reading or study. The word study in English almost sounds like you've contemplated it a little, like I'm studying calculus or something, you're trying to understand it. Here, the hearing and reading is just on one level, just kind of superficial level. When you contemplate that, trying to understand the distinction and the meaning of it, you develop a deeper appreciation, insight of the subject, and that the wisdom that arises in your consciousness is called a wisdom arisen from contemplation. Once you've understood that correctly, like say, for instance, you've contemplated that death comes to everyone and there's no way to avoid it, and that at the time of death, there's no extra time. You know, the Lord of death doesn't give you any extra time, and every moment you're getting closer to death. When you go through these meditations on death and impermanence, you have a correct understanding of that. Then you hold that in your contemplation without analyzing any longer through contemplation. You try to hold the conclusion that you've come to single-pointedly. Now, that stage, that kind of activity leaves a deeper kind of insight into your mind that's called the wisdom arisen from meditation. So you might say, when you're doing, analytical meditation on death and impermanence, it's called analytical meditation, but that's actually contemplation. You develop a wisdom arising from contemplation. Then when you've had the conclusion of that, you see clearly something, to leave an imprint deeply in your mind of that, you hold it single-pointedly without analyzing any longer. And a deeper insight arises called the wisdom arisen from meditation. So sometimes you forget the conclusion you had that you're trying to concentrate on, and become, then you have to go back to contemplating, analyzing. Then when you get that conclusion, oh yeah, yeah, that's true. There's no truly existent self. Then you hold that single-pointedly. That develops a deeper kind of understanding that's imbued in your consciousness that's called the wisdom arisen from meditation. Does that kind of touch your doubt about that?
Yes, that cleared it up. Thank you.
Okay, well, good questions. Okay, anyone else? Who is that? Naga.
So the final, if you ever want to become complete Buddha, is the monastery is the only way, or?
Oh, the Mahayana doesn't believe that. In the Theravada, some of the Theravada traditions, it said only a fully fully ordained monk, bhikshu in Sanskrit, can become Buddha. But generally, the Mahayana says that's not the case. Not only men, also women, obviously, and there's no need to become ordained. Although, in order to practice in some life, when conditions come about that are conducive, it might be a method to accelerate your practice. Like, remember I talked about leaving home, like in the 37 practices of the Bodhisattvas, it says it's the practice of the Bodhisattvas to recognize that at home there are objects of attachment and anger and so forth. And so it's the practice of the Buddha's sons to leave home. It means to leave beside the worldly concerns. So in some lifetime, it might be, even as you're practicing over many lifetimes as a layperson, at some lifetime, in order to accelerate your practice, to not be encumbered by concerns of commerce and making a living and, so forth and so on, and family, that you would take ordination. But it's not mandatory to achieve enlightenment. I remember at Copan, when I first was thinking, after the second course I'd attended, 74 and 75, I attended two courses, I was thinking to take ordination, and I went to see Lama Sopa Rinpoche to ask him his thoughts. And he had been following all of the students who had been to the previous course and this course. I think he'd made divinations and his own wisdom, and he said, for you, it would be very good to take ordination. Implication meaning, for some people in some lifetime, it's not the right time. But in certain circumstances, it might be something that can accelerate your practice to take ordination. Generally, though, we say in order to take, from the Gelugpa point of view, our tradition, to take the Bodhisattva vow, you have to have at least taken the lay vows. If not the vows of a monk or nun, you take the vows of a layperson. And that acts as the basis to receive the Bodhisattva vows. In some of the other traditions, Sakya, Nyingma, Kagyu, they say you can receive the Bodhisattva vows without that basis. You had something follow up, though. I think you were going to ask something else, right?
Yeah, I did go to the monastery in Theravada. Of course, he wanted to do Arhata for me. But
wait, I didn't catch what he wanted to do.
I did go to a monastery in Theravada.
Hmm.
And
did you take ordination? You became nun?
No.
He
could offer me. He said he could offer me, but I had my small children.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the other question is, I study different. I want to learn from different perspectives of Buddhism. So I haven't chosen which path is mine yet.
Yeah.
The other thing I have question is regarding Tantra. They make it so complicated that if you take tantric vows, then you have to practice and you have to go to the centers. And sometimes it makes you step back. Because then I don't know how long you have to practice if you study Tantra, what effects it can. The other one is if you become deity, if you're practicing for deity, then I feel when you're leaving all these, being Indian, you leave all the attachments of clothing or jewelry, but then the deities are so decorated. I'm already born with all this jewelry and
seems contradictory. So in terms of Tantra, if you receive an empowerment into a deity, that's not something that should be done casually. That's something where, in order to say, if you were to contemplate that, you should be very serious, not only being a Buddhist, definitely, taking refuge, and aiming for enlightenment, having taken the Bodhisattva vow. Those are prerequisites. So it's not something you know, someone first comes to the center and say, oh, today we're giving an empowerment, when should come? That's not proper. You need certain prerequisites. You need to know generally about the teachings of Buddhism and have strong faith and desire to achieve enlightenment as quickly as possible. And for most of us, we're just at the beginning stage. So it may not be, Tantra is not something that you have to even worry about. In fact, there are commitments. If you take empowerments, generally there are certain commitments. You have to either recite a certain number of mantra or do a certain practice every day. But certain gurus might give them without all of those commitments. However, you can visualize emanations of the Buddha, like Shakyamuni Buddha himself in front. And with great faith, imagine light and nectar coming to you as you recite his mantra, that light and nectar goes to all sentient beings as you recite the mantra, sort of for sentient beings and his blessings coming to them. Or Avalokiteshvara, Tara, Manjushri, you can do that without having taken any vows, having any commitments. That's legitimate. So you don't have to worry about that. In terms of the clothes of the deities, ornaments, you know, crown and earrings and precious silk and everything, those are, it's understood that the deities like this are not the gods of the desire realm, like Indra, or the gods of the form realm, like Brahma, but they are actually emanations of the omniscient mind. And they, when they emanate, they have certain characteristics like this, like royalty, that can inspire the mind. So for us to become the deity is maybe a long way off. There are some deities that have very few ornaments, like they're almost completely naked, like Vajrayogini. She just has some bone earrings and necklace and, you know, things like this. So if you like the ascetic, you can visualize that. But in general, there's no contradiction. You need to have, in order to practice Tantra, you need to have a sense of renunciation and not be so concerned about your appearance in this lifetime. But how you appear to others as a Buddha will have an impact on them. So you may appear with these, you know, jeweled ornaments or not. Sometimes the Buddha appears just as a monk or as a nun or something like that, you know. Okay, so I don't want to keep people. It's 4:00. I've had a great time. I hope it hasn't been too arduous for you. And I'd like to finish with a little dedication, as we've done before, the energy that we've created this course. So sit comfortably. Try to relax, get your equanimity back, relax your body. Relax your mind. Take a few inhalations and exhalations to focus on that. Bring your attention to your mental consciousness again. Let go of your mind wandering to other thoughts. Just look at the clear light nature of your mind. And recognize that this weekend, each time we've begun with a motivation, virtuous motivation that gives a certain outline of virtue to our activities. And during the teachings, we've tried to keep a certain amount of mindfulness and concentration, keeping our mind virtuous. So we've created a store of virtuous karma, perhaps many people in the world never create in their whole lifetime, just in this weekend. this will definitely, one of the characteristics of karma is that it is definite. That is to say that virtuous karma will definitely ripen, if it does, in pleasure and something pleasant. So to dedicate this merit so that it is not experienced just once in the future, like a bush or a plant, a tomato plant that just gives fruit once and then you have to plant again next year, but like an annual tree or bush that keeps on blossoming in the future. Dedicate these merits. Think, due to the virtue that I've created, the merits I've created, may it not ripen simply once in some superficial happiness of samsara, but in whatever way it ripens, may it enhance my spiritual practice from life to life, up to and including enlightenment, my eventual achievement of enlightenment. My mind will be totally clear, blissful, and able to bring about the benefit and happiness of all sentient beings. Due to these merits, may I quickly become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. Due to these merits, may all of the chaos of the world today, natural disasters of storms and hurricanes and fires and so forth, famine, disease, COVID and others, the frenetic minds of sentient beings in this degenerate age when the delusions become more rampant, may all of these unfavorable conditions be pacified by the accumulation of merit that I've created this weekend and in the past and in the future. And may sentient beings abide in a period of, you know, favorable conditions and develop easily realizations that benefit themselves and all other sentient beings due to these merits. And then finally, seal the dedication, this conventional dedications, conventional in the sense that you're thinking of things without necessarily understanding their emptiness. Seal them in what's called the emptiness of the three spheres. The agent, oneself, who's doing the dedicating, and one's mind, which is the instrument of yourself, are both empty of inherent existence. The goals dedicated to the achievement of realizations, the peaceful conditions of the world, one's own eventual enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings, all of these things appear and do function conventionally like appearances, but like illusions, like dreams, they're devoid of the existence that we attribute to them. They're empty of inherent existence. In the action of dedication, joining these merits that we've created with these goals is also, although to our mind we might think we've made a dedication, you can't find the act of dedication anywhere upon its parts. It's just a name that we give to this combination of strong resolution or prayer or wish that these merits ripen in those ways that we call dedication. This is called sealing the dedication in the emptiness of the three spheres, the agent, the object, and the action. So thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and great questions, really very perceptive and useful questions for everyone. Tomorrow night, if you want to join, there'll be another talk just for discovering Buddhism on Tantra, not going into the details, but some of the other ways, some of the other packed things about Tantra. And next weekend, the center has asked if I would teach a seminar on the Heart Sutra, the heart of the perfection of wisdom. So that's talking mainly about emptiness. This time was mainly about bodhicitta with a little bit of emptiness. Next week will be mainly about emptiness with a little bit of bodhicitta. Get a good balance. So have a good time today, the rest of your day. Hopefully we'll see you again in the future, not so soon. Take care.
Thank you, Honorable George.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable George.
Thank you, Robbie.
Thank you, Honorable George.
Thank you.